You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Welcome. I am Michaela Novak, Senior Fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. The podcast episode today is the first of a three-part Hayek Program podcast mini-series on entangled political economy. Entangled political economy is a sub-discipline of political economy that explicitly views individuals and the private and public sectors as being intertwined in overlapping exchange relationships along competitive and collaborative dimensions. Inspired by a long tradition in political economy stretching back to Adam Smith and Karl Menger, and drawing upon insights found in complexity, evolutionary, and network theories, entangled political economy studies have expanded significantly in recent years. Entangled political economy specialists have established a research network to promote the research and study of entangled political economy. This body, the Entangled Political Economy Research Network, or abbreviated as EPERN, was established in 2020, and I am an associate director of that network. Richard Wagner is Emeritus Professor of Economics at George Mason University, as well as Distinguished Senior Fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Previously, he was the Hobart R. Harris Professor of Economics at George Mason University. Dick received his doctorate in economics from the University of Virginia in 1966. He joined the faculty of George Mason University in 1988. After holding positions at the University of California, Irvine, Tulane University, Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, Auburn University, and Florida State University. During his tenure at George Mason University, he served as chair of the Department of Economics from 1989 to 1995, and as the director of graduate studies 1998 to 2004, and from 2006 to 2012. Wagner has an accomplished academic record, it is fair to say, in fields of interest spanning public finance, macroeconomics, and political economy, to name just a few. He is the author of more than 200 articles in professional journals and the author or editor of approximately 30 books and monographs. Some of the journalistic outlets in which his research work appears include the American Economic Review, Public Choice, Kyklos, Journal of Law and Economics, Constitutional Political Economy, the Review of Austrian Economics, and Journal of Public Finance and Public Choice. As an aside, this record of intellectual achievement keeps growing even in retirement. In 2023 alone, as far as I can count, Dick has published three books and several journal articles. The significance of Dick's appearance on this podcast is that he is the intellectual progenitor of the entangled political economy framework. We have now a wonderful opportunity to discuss the origins, significance, and prospective directions of entangled political economy as a research program. Dick, welcome. It is really a very great pleasure to have you as guest for this episode of the Hayek Program Podcast.
Thank you. And it's a pleasure for me to be able to sit here and chat with you as well.
Thank you very much. So we'd like to start off by thinking about the origins of entangled political economy. And admittedly, to be able to sort of pinpoint the exact origins of this research program would be difficult, not only in reflection of your own broad ranging interests, but can regard entangled political economy as a sort of a function, I guess, of encounters with not only scholarly figures during your career, but also with a range of intellectual artifacts, journal articles, books, and whatnot. So we have to understand that the origins of any academic program will reflect these rather complicated considerations. But nonetheless, let me start off with this. So as you well know, and as a number of our listeners know, in 1964, the Southern Economic Association presidential address of James McGill Buchanan was published. That address, entitled What Should Economists Do, exposits that the neoclassical political economy paradigm is predominated by an understanding of the economic problem of allocating scarce means among alternative or competing ends. Buchanan pleaded with his scholarly peers to embrace a political economy paradigm of exchange, meaning that the economic problem is reframed as to how individuals secure mutual gains through cooperative endeavor, through exchange, agreement, or trade. So my sort of question here, Dick, is how influential in your mind was Buchanan's SEA presidential address upon your own thinking concerning the appropriate modality for thinking in political economy?
I think it was quite significant and has been to this very day. That paper was given at my first year as a graduate student, and I latched onto it. It made great sense to me because what it was saying is that economics is about transactions. And it's not about someone shoving people around to optimize social utility, but the whole world is constructed through the many, many transactions in which people engage. And that has stayed with me forever. And in fact, I could raise you, you might say, a bit and say that what when I left Virginia, my first job was at University of California at Irvine in the social science division, of which the dean was James March, who had written books with Herbert Simon. And March didn't want to have ordinary departments, and he wanted to have a general school of social science. Irvine was on a quarter system, and what March did for all new faculty was have them teach two of the three quarters of a sequence on introduction to social science. Now, in my case, I didn't teach in the quarter where they taught economics and political science. I did teach both a sequence of anthropology and sociology, along with a sequence of psychology and geography, that were the other four disciplines at that time in the social science division. And, you know, I absolutely loved doing that, because these quarters, there were 10-week sequences, and you were teaching the what you thought were the basic principles to a room full of undergraduates. And I couldn't have been happier. There was nothing I really couldn't cover, except here I was, a brand new professor out of graduate school, and I was spending nearly all of my time preparing classes. And I came to realize that I was not likely to be in a position to get tenure a few years down the road if I end up doing this. But I loved it. But I knew I had to get out of that. And so I moved to Tulane University 2 years later, but that has stuck with me all the way. And to this day, I have often thought that I would have loved it if the chance to teach in a program like that had come along, say, 20 years later. But, you know, things come along when they do, and you do the best you can with the situations you face.
Absolutely. And in passing, in a reaction to your sort of response there, you did mention anthropology, sociology, and even geography. And I wondered whether teaching in those sort of subjects at that time may have actually further quenched your appetite for Buchanan's plea for an exchange paradigm, to the extent that these subjects may have emphasized some sort of element of social exchange in relation to anthropology, sociology, geography in terms of exchange over space. I wonder if that may have been the case for you. I'm not too sure.
Absolutely, it was. Exchange was everywhere there. And of course, you could read between the lines, so to speak, and see it more there. Anthropologists, for instance, have long had a interest in exchange, in money, and so forth. In sociology, one of the fascinating books in sociology that I remember working on back at that time was George Simmel's Philosophy of Money. That's a big book, probably 800 pages or so, as I recall. And what was really fascinating to me is he opens the book saying that not a single word of this book is about economics. And yet I thought it was all about economics as I read it. But yet it wasn't traditional economic discourse. What Simmel was most concerned with was the ever-changing boundaries of what makes for acceptable exchange in various societies, and how that is continually changing. And I like the way Simmel approached that question, too, because it was in an explanatory mode. How can you give an account of at one time or one place people take their elderly parents into their houses to care for them? At another time or another place, that care is farmed out to some professional service giver. And often these changes of boundaries are accompanied by a good deal of controversy and conflict as they take place. And it reminds me, too, there's a, can't think of the author's name right now, one of the things that I recognize it as starting to go now that I've reached 83 is sometimes recalling names quickly. That's why sometimes I have to look at bibliographies I've made to recall a name I'm trying to recall. But there was Michael Sandel is the name of the guy I'm trying to remember all of a sudden. He wrote this book called What Money Can't Buy. But that was just a total normative kind of exhalation of what he liked or didn't like, whereas Simmel was covering the same territory of what money can buy, what money can't buy. But Simmel was trying to give a social explanation that allowed you to understand the kinds of processes that are underway in societies, whereas Sandel was simply evacuating the contents of his normative brain. And so I've always carried forward these kinds of interest, and likewise entanglement. That I think entanglement, you know, I've often said that I think economics as a discipline was on better ground in classical times than in neoclassical times, because neoclassical represented a kind of a narrowing down and the conversion of economics into a kind of an administrative science. But as an administrative science, that makes it almost a governmental science, and I didn't want to do that. Whereas classical economists were about how to understand the kinds of processes by which societies work well, work poorly. And that vision of economics leads into a general or universal theory of society. We all live in societies, and societies interaction. You can't really say, well, this is politics, this is social, this is economics, because all it is human action. People are doing things, but always doing things in conjunction with other, with disapproval of others or with approval of others. It's all this pot of people, or various pots of people. And that's what we're trying to understand, is how they work, when they fall apart, and whether if they fall apart, they repair themselves, and how, all these things. It's society that is our scientific object of interest. And I've never thought about it as anything more than that. And it goes back to Virginia, yes. It also goes back and got a huge boost for my 2 years at Irvine, when I found what I really loved about thinking about things and writing about things. And
no, excellent. So let's just leap forward in time. So much later in your career, in a 2018 chapter for Becky and Stein's volume entitled Buchanan's Tensions, you mused that public choice and mainline political economy might well have assumed a qualitatively differing character. Is some of the intellectual insights of, let's say, elite theory were more systematically embraced. So can I ask then, when you first encountered the class theoretic stylings of the Italian fiscal and political sociologists such as Prieto and Mosca, were your initial discoveries through Buchanan's 1960 survey of the Italian traditional fiscal theory or elsewhere? And and as part of that, I do note that in a recent chapter of yours, a brief autobiography of yours in a book that's just been released called Libertarian Autobiographies by Cavallo and Bloch, you do mention that you became intrigued, at least, with Pareto whilst you were a graduate student. So I'm interested in your discovery about sort of Pareto, if you're able to trace that to some point in time or some sort of period in your career.
Didn't get too much into Pareto as a graduate student. That mostly came later, although, you know, a lot of these characters are on your radar screen, so to speak, but you have the ability to have many more people recognizable on your radar screen than you could at any one moment dig into. And there are lots of things of people I would make preliminary examinations to some extent and say, oh, that's good. But I'm busy right now, and come back to it. And I've never been someone who, like, for instance, keeps diaries or all of anything like this. And so I know, for instance, Buchanan kept diaries, but I've never adopted that practice. And so I often find myself, kind of up in the air as to what the order, the sequence of things were. But Pareto, I know, Well, I don't really know. And among the Italians, I think probably the one I came across first was Pareto, because Pareto was available in English back in the 1930s. And I didn't work on picking up rudimentary reading knowledge of Italian until, I don't know, probably maybe 1980 or in the 70s or somewhere. And so that's when I expanded my awareness of the Italians. But at first, what you had available in English translation back in my very early days would have been Pareto and Mosca, I think, were the ones. Maybe one or two others. I never kept diaries of my comings and goings. But those Italians of that time all had a kind of a healthy skepticism about claims of promoting public beneficence through power, and which I think was also part of that Machiavellian tradition to which they all adhered. And it was just where around in this country, for instance, there's huge credulity given. There's some questions, but it seems to be fracturing into two now. But whether you're a Democrat or Republican, a Trumpian or Biden or whatever, it's like there are two polarities, all of whom want to believe politicians, where I grew up in a tradition that basically was skeptical of all politicians, because you're always pretending to do things for other people for their good, for which there's probably little limit to which you might go. It reminds me, it was a poem by Hilary Billet. It was called Epitaph on the Politician. And it goes, "Here, richly with ridiculous display, the politician's corpse was laid away, while all of his acquaintance sneered and slang. I wept, for I had longed to see him hanged." And that is my outlook and orientation on politicians. I can recognize some politics as necessary for good civil order, but I think it rapidly depreciates. Perhaps back in the late 19th century, with governments around 10% of GDP and very little regulation, that was probably, I hesitate to say optimal, but it was probably a pretty good way of people living together, because then things that you want to have done or changed, you have to work it out among the interested participants. Now you go to some agency or another to do it. In fact, a former Mason student, Meg Tuzinski, and I have just finished this book that we've called Reason and Ideology and Entangled Political Economy that Palgrave Macmillan is going to publish. And it carries out some of these themes, and not in the sense of trying to advocate an op-ed kind of fashion for one thing or another, but rather through exploring, digging into the logical connections and relationships through which different social systems operate. And our sense of this book is that people who read this and understand it will be small government people and will know why.
Excellent. So let's now turn to thinking about entangled political economy as a maturing research program that unfolds over time. So My sort of first point of stopping will be your 2007 book entitled Fiscal Sociology and the Theory of Public Finance. And I think this book is quite indispensable insofar as it opens analytical vistas of fiscal sociology for political economists. So as you know, fiscal sociology occupies a venerable place within the social sciences. For example, from Schumpeter's essay, The Crisis of the Tax State, through to modern-day treatments illustrating the determination of taxes, expenditure, and public borrowings as reflective of a contestable political process in the world. So my question is, so in this sort of world, are the inhabitants of Western societies anywhere closer today to appreciating the significance of the fiscal threats at hand that they face? So public debt overhang, excessive spending, the sort of looming increases in taxation burdens if any of those other sort of fiscal variables aren't corrected? Or is sort of fiscal sociology, our beliefs about the propriety of fiscal practices, even the sort of normative values attached to them, are they still playing a predominant role in obfuscating the true costs of our fiscal overindulgences, which I believe sooner or later must be confronted? What are your views about these issues?
I think they will eventually have to be confronted. Thomas Sowell, in many cases, has remarked that reality is not optional. And it's good to remember that because our politics proceeds as if it's all fantasy and illusion, and or delusion, I might say. That, and you know, as far back as I can remember, as a student, that periodically legislatures have gone through big budget reform. There's always a recognition that spending is growing too rapidly, being spent on too many useless things, and yet we seem to be hopeless to do anything about it. So in one big rush of enthusiasm, we come up with a new arrangement. We have a Budget and Control Act of 1964, another act of 70-something. It just never ends. And I'm now actually on a mailing list for some new budgetary reform caucus underway now. And nothing has changed. And I think this is an inherent feature of what happens when you get away from the private ordering relationships created by private property and freedom of contract, where business gets done, activities get supported as people put their capital together to form some cooperative endeavor, and with their shares of capital governing their relative responsibilities and how that activity fares. The instant you move this into collective activity, what you do is divorce any sense of responsibility for what's going on, because you appropriate through taxation rather than pledging your capital to support an endeavor. And it's never going to work as well. And the logic of it tells you you shouldn't expect it to work well. And yet we do, because for the most part, people are wise not to pay much attention to what goes on in politics because they can't do anything about it anyway. And I think the old traditional Greeks sort of recognized that democracy had some very severe limits that made it at best a kind of a temporary kind of affair. And eventually people can learn what they can do when they are free of the responsibility that comes from opening business enterprises with your capital and relying upon the ability to attract customers to be successful. And there is, you know, Western civilization and the members of it discovered that well earlier on, as Harold Berman articulated in his Law and Revolution book, and as Berman also recognized that in the last century or so, the foundations of that have been eroding, if not crumbling, and that I hope that book with Meg and I wrote will help to contribute to shoring up the traditional foundations of Western civilization and privately ordered governance.
Yes, and so it is arguable from another book of yours, your 2016 effort, Politics as a Peculiar Business, with the subtitle Insights from a Theory of Entangled Political Economy, is that it's probably that in itself is the most definitive treatment, I think, a single treatment of entangled political economy. What now, one attribute of many from that book which caught my own eye when reading the publication for the first time was the skillful negotiation on your part in integrating economic and sociological dimensions of human action and entangled interactivity through organizations and other collective entities. I'm wondering, would you care to share with listeners just how is it that economizing action blends with sociological issues, for example, the tendency toward articulation of rhetoric and sentiment in non-logical environments to inform our structured living togetherness, or perhaps sort of tensions in the ways in which we interact that you've just elucidated now with respect to budgetary and fiscal policy?
Certainly, I very much reject any kind of idea that you can separate what you might call economic motivation from social motivation. One example, I think I've used it on a couple of occasions to try to make this point, is look at Albert Schweitzer and Adolf Hitler were rough contemporaries. I think they're about 20 years apart. Schweitzer grew up, I guess, in the French-German area, Hitler in Austria, but both migrated to find ways of pursuing their ambitions and their dreams. Schweitzer moved to, I think it was Gabon or Central Africa, someplace to become a medical missionary. He had published some theological books in the search for the historical Jesus, I think was one of them, and had a established career as a theologian, and he replaced that with a medical missionary because he felt that he could do more good in the world that way. Now, doing good in the world is an abstract thing, and we should all recognize when we talk about our theories that there is the form a theory takes, and there's a substantive content with which that theory develops. And Schweitzer, as an abstract theorist, was trying to use his life to promote what he sensed was as much good in the world as he could. Can't you say the same thing about Adolf Hitler? He moved from Austria to Germany because there was more action. He could have a more robust, he thought, political career, we might infer. And he wanted to make the world better for an Aryan type of personality. Now, a lot of people would say that's not doing good in the world because it excludes me. But Hitler's welfare function, nonetheless, the formality of it was doing well in the world. Whether substantively, it's a different matter. But in terms of, is that an economic thing or is it a non-economic thing? It's just a thing. It's what, and if you take Buchanan's Cost and Choice, that's what he lays out very clearly, that every choice is going to have at least two options. And the one you accept, one you don't. And the one you don't accept is the next highest value of to the one you did accept. And so it's not like, well, I'm behaving economically on Monday and socially relevant on Tuesday. It's, or I'm doing some things because I want to for myself as a physiological entity, and I'm doing other things because I like the way people smile when I do these kinds of things and I feel good about it. I mean, I don't think you can meaningfully separate any of those things. Now, I think you can ask questions about whether different kinds of social environments influence the kinds of orientations people take towards themselves and their lives. I think there's something which I still need to elaborate sometime. This is all speculative right now, but I think there's something about status, highly governmental types of organizations that promote what you might call kinds of proletarian kinds of orientations and mentalities that bring out the lower or lesser of our capabilities, the less generous sides of us, than when people are acting on their own with their own capital and so forth. And so I think a privately ordered society is a more generous society, for instance, whereas a publicly ordered society is a very skimpy, entitlement-based, ugly, in many ways, kind of society. But those are all things that I have on the drawing boards for what I want to be doing in the near future.
Yeah, so I think that that does certainly sound very intriguing. I've been considering pursuing an independent line of inquiry to think about sort of the status mode of organization is not only sort of having the descriptors that you've indicated, but also sort of featuring lovelessness. But even within that, we can think of the various rhetorical investments, especially undertaken by political actors to try to sort of frame their sort of activities, even if they have sort of loveless implications and effects in terms of, let's say, sort of a gamut of losers, unwinning third parties arising, deriving from such activity. But nonetheless, they try to assuage sort of the broader sort of population of the sort of the righteousness, the goodness of their interventions. And so there's immense rhetorical investment to try to make other people actually feel good for the policy interventions that unfold. So I think that's actually quite significant, what you're sort of putting on the table here.
Well, thank you. And maybe some other listeners will pursue some of these lines too, because I think there's a very significant line of question in terms of collectively, what are we doing to ourselves with the kinds of arrangements that we generate and create in conjunction with the kinds of fairy tales we tell ourselves? By fairy tales, I mean such things as the presumptiveness that when people get into their political mode of operation as legislatures, as bureaucrats, executive agencies, they move into a higher, more socially responsible plane, where in the contrary, Adam Smith once remarked that, "I know of no good that comes from people who claim to trade on the public good." And you add that to Samuel Johnson, who noted to the effect that, people are seldom so innocently engaged as when they're making money. I think the classicals and the Scottish Enlightenment, all those characters had the sense of morality far superior to modern people. Modern people, it's markets that are suspicious, questionable. Politics is the big corrective force. It's just the reverse. Politics is the force of lying again and again and again. And it's in the small platoons of Burke, I guess, recognized that is really where the best sides of human nature are drawn out. And so all of our, I think, our rhetoric as well as our political actions are still pointed very much in a destructive condition. And I think in the United States, the next election, I think, may be important, but it's not going to be any massive correction that, because the correction that takes place has to come about in terms of the kinds of orientations that people have, which goes back to a theme that was dear to Vincent Ostrom's heart, which was recognition that to call upon political resolution of problems is to embrace a Faustian bargain. You're making a bargain with the devil. You're promising, well, give me the power to do this and everything will be well afterwards, when the power this day will be replaced by another power next day and the day after, and it'll never end. And so it's the problems we face are far more severe than what we typically think.
Yes, indeed. And speaking about correction, I see your 2020 book, in fact, Macroeconomics as Systems Theory, as an effort of intellectual correction to the extent that it illustrates how macroeconomic phenomena are necessarily seen in a complex system theory built upon the edifice of emergent orders as the byproduct of interactions by diverse agents in commercial capacities, non-commercial capacities, as at micro or meso levels of interaction. So significantly, I don't think it can be the other way around, as mistakenly suggested by mythological and analytical holists of all stripes. So policy scholarship and application seems unable to easily shake off reductionist concepts of macroeconomy, for this is possibly ideologically incompatible with economic planning mentalities. I'm wondering what you think about this. If we assume that non-complex macroeconomic theory and policy is shaken off, then how might you see thinking about macroeconomic issues and policy practices changing, if at all?
Macroeconomics is really represents an effort to think about the properties of the system inside of which we all live. That's where the classical economists had a macroeconomics. They wondered, they thought to count, every once in a while there was a sense that there were periods of inflation or depression would come about, and they wondered what could have brought them up about. And the sense there was, well, within a system of generally flexible prices and things like that, freedom of contract, any kinds of macro disturbances would be self-correcting disturbances. I think that is largely still true today, but it there's more to the story that could be developed than has been, and there's no point, I think, in trying to go back and relive pre-Keynesian kinds of economic models, and there's more involved. But in these days, there's, you know, there's much more to questions of what makes what are the properties of the systems of order inside of which we all live. And the systems of order are continually undergoing change to this very day. And in part, it's a inescapable feature of a world that is, realistically speaking, getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Now we can change, we can shift messages from one part of the world to another practically instantly and traverse the globe within a day. And we can learn things, transmit ideas, but we can also unlearn things. So just because something, an idea goes from one place to another doesn't mean it's a good idea. Bad ideas can be transmitted as well, and I think there's an awful lot of what you might call international governance ideas that are bad ideas pursued by things like United Nations and all of these things, when there are many things the old standards of conventions and so forth can be used to bring about some uniformity of sentiments and practices without engaging in legislation. And I, but still, it is, if the world is becoming smaller in a realistic sense. And I think it's unfortunate if that smaller means more what we mean by government. In an international sense, which could have been provided through conventions. And so, you know, macroeconomics is right now, you know, it's the entering wedge. It's the ability of governments to justify practically everything can be justified on the basis of economic conditions demanded, and where it's simply not true.
Indeed. And so now let's think about the future of entangled political economy. I mean, it must be gratifying to see how the political economy scholarly community has continued to engage with the framework of entangled political economy that you have developed. Of course, there is always more work to do, not only in a conceptual sense, but in analytical and empirical contexts. In this regard, it is notable, and I had mentioned this during the outset, that subsequent to your retirement, you've already published three books, at least on my count, as well as numerous peer-reviewed journal articles. You've actually foreshadowed another book project that is coming. But I would actually like to turn your attention and the attention of our listeners to one of the two books published more recently by Edward Elgar. And this is your book entitled Rethinking Public Choice. So in your words, what are the deficiencies of mainstream public choice analysis that you're attempting to critically appraise in that book? And what areas or what public choice theorists turn their minds to more vigorously, in your opinion?
With respect to recent public choice, probably my, I don't like to mention favorite in the sense of one, two, three so much, but I like a lot of the old standards. You know, I grew up with Buchanan and Tulloch, for instance. One of my very favorites with respect to modern public choice, and as reflected in that Elgar book of mine, is Vincent Ostrom. And I think in particular, he had this 1997, I think it was, book on de Tocqueville. And what I like especially about Ostrom is Ostrom could have been on that faculty at Irvine. Oh, he's 20 years older than me. But, I mean, in terms of the range of his interest, he would have been right at home there. But the kind of question becomes, what goes on within any kind of political system? Well, that's going to... Let me take a step back there, because speaking of Ostrom, it was also Ostrom who articulated the idea of a Faustian bargain, use of government as a Faustian bargain. Now, I've sometimes wondered, wouldn't it be nice if there were a Gallup poll on agree or disagree? Is the resort to government a Faustian bargain? Now, there might be a problem of how many people would know what a Faustian bargain is these days, the way curriculums have been deadened and so forth, from at least from what I hear. But assuming that people would understand what a Faustian bargain is, if you go back two centuries, I have no doubt that you would have a widespread notion, acceptance of the Faustian bargain idea. If you look, for instance, of the controversy within this country between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, it was an intense controversy that went on for a year and a half or 2 years, about controversy over the ratification of the Constitution, with the Anti-Federalists being opposed to the ratification and wanting to stay with the Articles of Confederation. And that whether you read the Federalists or the Anti-Federalists, there is no disagreement there about government's use being a Faustian bargain of embracing evil because you hope to get more good out of it. Now, the differences, there were intense differences there, but those differences were what you might call empirical differences. One type of difference would be that it was recognized that after the Revolution, that colonists were going to start spilling to the West. And there was a serious question of whether the states under the Articles could keep peace among the various states that were claiming territory to the West, or whether that would require a national government. That was a serious question, an empirical question. It wasn't a question that you could answer just on principle. Oh, this is lovely, that's not. That's not that kind of question. And another empirical question was, well, we fought off the British with the help of the French. Might the French come back? Might the British come back? And the Spaniards were in Florida, and as well as in the West. So what would be the future of 13 states as against a single national state? That, again, there were serious questions, and that controversy reflected it. But it was a serious question that all rested, the Faustine bargain it was. Now, move forward 2 centuries. How much support would you think you might imagine finding for the Faustian claim? I suspect almost none. I suspect, I think it's probably cross parties. I think there's probably, from what I read about Democratic parties and editorials and so forth, that there's probably no Democrat Party member who would support the Faustian claim and rather would say that it's power, it's a government that is the best hope we have for creating just, equitable, non-discriminatory, et cetera, societies. Without governmental power, it'll just all be survival of the fittest and so forth. And I suspect the Republicans wouldn't be all that far different either. And I think there's a huge educational work to be done, I suppose. But anyway, through all that, Vincent Ostrom and the types of questions he raised in the 1997 book on Tocqueville, it had a long title. I can't remember the full title, but he probably would be my favorite character in that respect. But also, you see that what's going on by mentioning Ostrom, too, is attaching to my own background in terms of refusing to say that there are economic questions and non-economic questions. I'd say rather that there are, on the one hand, there are two types of questions, social questions. On the one hand, there's questions that each of us face as individuals of what are we going to do with ourselves, our time, our talents. And then there is a second set of questions of what happens when you move away from a world where you have Robinson Crusoe that you can focus on and have thousands or millions of those people all together. And what are they going to do? How are you going to understand what goes on? I mean, that is our world as social sciences, is organized humanity. And you can ask such questions as, what are the possibilities of organized humanity? I don't think that's an easy question to address. But for instance, one line of thought familiar to public choice theorists is, for the most part, it's not really of much interest to people to spend much time dealing with politics unless you jump in. And you need not jump in the sense of wanting to become a candidate, but you can jump in the sense of, if you have the wealth, becoming a donor, or you can jump in the sense of becoming a party professional and you get to go to conventions and all this sort of stuff. There are various things that you can do, but most people won't do and don't care to do. And so politics is an affair that has relatively limited knowledge at work inside of it for most people, and which understandably, I think, gives an advantage to people who are the custodians of complex kinds of questions that are important, whether it be big tech, any number of things, and which is where public choice has always, I think, been in terms of a recognition of the value of interest groups. But it's in a way, it's the same old. What I tried to do in that one book is introduce it a bit more. You know, the idea of a social system in a state of long-run equilibrium, where all trades have been transacted and there's nothing left to do, is a kind of an end of history articulation that just disturbs me. I can recognize it as a formal shell. It's not substantive, it's just a form. And so if you say you have this equilibrium form, and so in that form you have categories for market prices, factor prices, demand, supply, you have these categories, or what was one time called these analytical boxes. The shell is just a kind of a filing cabinet. I suppose I find myself unsatisfied with thinking of our theories as that kind of formal shell that has no substantive content to it, and want to think of our theories as being helpful in understanding how life takes shape, how it might look to be going off the cliff. And I think to do that, to satisfy that desire in your theories, you have to have theories that, still, all theories are going to be abstract and formal, but you have to have theories that make some point of contact with what you sense to be really going on in life. And if you think that it's possible that, if we know, one thing we can gather from the historical record is that there are all kinds of flourishing societies at one time that later disappear or become highly depressed. And I suspect if you were to dig into them, people have, Rome being one of the favorite ones, but dig into them, that what you're going to find is these are all things that, in one way or another, the processes of those societies did it to them. It wasn't conquest from outside. It was degeneration from inside. And I think that means that if you believe that, as I do, then you have to work in the direction of creating theories that, on the one hand, seem to be reasonably descriptively accurate of how things work, because you want to take that descriptively accurate quality and say, oh, here's where we're going into the toilet of what's causing it. We're going downhill because we have too many of the things being done politically for which no one has any capital interest in terms of investing in it, and that kind of thing. And so that's part of my intuitive methodology as to why I took this public choice book in, I would call it a bit of a realistic move, though I realize that no theory is going to be realistic. That's impossible. There are always abstractions. But I need to have a set of abstractions where readers can see, oh, this is what's going on, and this is going to make that happen. And so I think that's because I believe that life in general is going downhill in various ways, as many people have commented on or remarked on. And so that's what I feel that to address those concerns, you have to do two things. You have to have a descriptively accurate, reasonably accurate theory, and you have to explain the logic of the systems inside of which we are living, where you can see how the self-interested actions of participants is bringing this about. I mean, nothing happens because no one wants it to happen. Everything happens because someone or some set of people want it to happen. And it just so happens that in some cases, those things are going to turn out positive. Other times, they're going to turn out negative. And we need our theoretical models to discern the difference.
Yes, indeed. And so for entangled political economy to constitute as a productive research program, I think it must, in your teacher and collaborator James Buchanan's vernacular, proceed onwards and upwards. And I think this is what we must do. And so without further ado, I'd like to thank you, Dick, for the opportunity for this discussion today. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, and we should all move upwards and onwards.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.